Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories. You're listening to CJSF Radio 9.1 FM, broadcasting from the traditional and unceded territories of the Coast Salish people, including the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Coquitlam and Katsi nations. Unceded means that these lands have never been surrendered, sold, or given up by these nations and were currently situated in occupied territories. With that in mind, welcome everyone. My name is Iago, and today I'm presenting here our honored guest named Jim Layden. He's an Indigenous elder, land defender, a powerful voice for climate justice advocacy right here in British Columbia. He's been the forefront at the fight against the TMX pipeline for a long time, and his work has demonstrated a great demonstration of strength, resilience, and a fight that is important for all of us when it comes to a sustainable future. So, Jim, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Would you like to introduce yourself a little bit better, your background, your culture, where you come from?
Sure. My name is Stemmikoch Kanem. It's a spirit name that's been given at Sundance and stuff, right? And it means Stem is little, Mekoch is black bear, Kanem is warrior, right? So it's little black bear warrior. And it came about because at one point we were first setting up one of the Sundances. There was a baby, like less than a year old, bear running down the hill. So I ran out to kind of make sure. I wasn't sure if it was hunters that were after or whatever, right? So I kind of got out there so I could be seen. And I don't even know. I never did see what it was running from, but they ended up, that's like... So the little is aimed at the bear. So I was told later we could eliminate the Mekoch and just be... eliminate Stem and just be Mekoch Kanem. Because the bear is not little anymore. I was adopted into a Scottish family named the Laydens, hence my name, James McNeil Layden. I was put into care. They talk about the 60 scoop. My mother was Anishinaabe, my father was Irish. I was put into care basically at around 1 year of age to start with, and taken out a couple of times, put back in. And I stayed in the Children's Aid in Ontario in care, in the Children's Aid, till I was seven. I was adopted into a family, moved away from my hometown, which was Brantford. And I moved away from my hometown and into Oakville, Ontario. And that was one of their policies at that point, was to separate the families, other than putting them in the foster cares. So it was an adoption. It usually didn't happen in the hometown. So they moved me to Oakville. And that's significant because a part of my, I also ended up, as is the history of a lot of people who have been through care, I ended up as a drug addict and an alcoholic. Got clean for that. I'm now like 39 years clean and sober. Why I became an activist, I guess, because what happened in youth was an absolute disempowerment. So it seemed really natural for me to go into situations where I was empowering people, where I was standing up for those that had been abused, or standing up for society, as happens with the pipeline. And the first time I got arrested, I... I basically told him I wanted to get arrested. I said, I want to get this in front of the courts, and you guys can take it from there and determine that we are on unceded territory, we're in sovereign land, and we have the right to tell you what we can do and what you can do on this land. You don't have the right to put a pipeline through our land without our permission. And so that's part of that. I was involved before that in fights around homelessness in Vancouver, and I started off as a young teenager, like 13 years old, in high school, fighting over the California grapes boycott and being part of an underground media, underground press, that was really reporting a whole bunch on the Vietnam War and stuff at the time. So I kind of raised right from there. There's always been a thread of activism throughout my life, and I think that ties back into the fact that I was so disempowered by being put in the children's aid and adopted out of my community and everything else. I always remember the last foster home I was at, standing there with a little suitcase in one hand and a small apple tree in the other that I had started from scratch, and wondering why the hell I was having, why I was being taken away from this family. We seemed to get along well. But that was always their policy there, was you never stayed in a family for very long. So I moved around for several families and ended up getting my training in social work and counseling and stuff, and took that on as my corporate career, I guess, is my mm-hmm. But I always have connected with the land. And I remember kayaking up. We were the first kayak, myself and another fella. We were the first kayaks on the Indian Arm. Deep Cove used to be Deep Cove Canoes, and that's all they sold was canoes, or rented was canoes. But we took the kayaks, and we went up the Indian Arm River, and you could see the salmon. You hear people talking about that, and I can testify that it's real. You can see all this red on the bottom of the river.
And I wanted to maybe transition a little bit to your life as an activist. I mean, you've mentioned that all you've done and how all this pressure has led you to activism, right? Mm-hmm. So can you share a little bit of how was the start of this life for you? And
well, first of all, I take my directions from my elders. And the elders basically said, get yourself arrested, take this to the legal system and see what you can do. And I was actually successful with some of that. So when the first time I got arrested, it seemed like no one else was going to get arrested. And Judy Wilson, one of our elder leaders, she was speaking the one day, and she basically said, it's time for people to get arrested. So I went, got arrested. And they tried to condemn that. They can't understand the relationship between elders and their and the people. Anyway, I got arrested, and as they were starting to arrest me, I said to them, the only people that should be arrested are you. I'm talking about the police. I said, because I'm sitting on unsurrendered, sovereign territory. And as a sovereign territory, we have the right to say who can be here and who can't. And we've never approved of the pipeline. And none of the other nations, white nations and that around here have approved of the pipeline. And so we're here to tell you to get out, that you can't be here. And I said, if anyone should be arrested, it's you, because you're on our territory imposing yourselves upon us. I ended up in court, and I couldn't argue that I shouldn't be convicted, because it already admitted to the fact that I wanted to be arrested. So that's what do they call it? Mens rea. That's me showing them my intent to be mm-hmm. arrested and my knowledge of what I was doing. But then it went from there, and we had no... they gave no consideration, the judge and prosecutors specifically, gave no consideration to the fact that there were rules and laws and everything else that had been passed saying that indigenous people, they should look for alternatives to sending them to jail. And the judge basically said, well, no, if I can't send if I have to send non-Indigenous people to jail, then I should have to send Indigenous people to jail, which falls really short, because at that point, well, we were the first Indigenous people to be sentenced to jail, and there had been a few people with 1 and 2 days, but we had significant, you know, we were 28 days, myself and another fellow called Stacy. And another fellow called Tellum, all three of us were arrested the same day and went through the process together, because we had common claim that we should have. There is an alternate court that they can send you to. There's alternate things to jailhouse, jail sentencing. And this all came out of... there's a thing called the Gladue Report, where a woman named Gladue, the judge took a look at her life and said, well, She spent her whole life, she hasn't had a chance in life. She spent her whole life, everything she did, she was sentenced to jail. And then they looked at the fact that 70% of the population in some of our provinces are Indigenous. They're the population, Indigenous, the jailhouse population, while less than 7% of the population in those provinces are Indigenous. So it's a great disproportion. So they said, you need to look at other ways. We need to bring in a number of Indigenous people down that are going to jail. She refused to consider it. She refused to transfer our case over to an Indigenous court that would have elders involved in it and determine our sentencing through there. So while I was in jail, I launched an appeal, but I was still in for about 4 or 5 days. And I ended up getting seriously ill. They weren't giving me my medications, and we're actually fighting that right now. So that's the first case. I ended up after jail. I ended up in St. Paul's Hospital with a serious bacterial infection in my body, and they couldn't even put shunts or anything in because they would get infected. And I spent a couple weeks on breathing tubes and feeding tubes and everything else, and came pretty close to dying. I said to the nurse, I was just going to go home last night instead of coming in here. She said, well, you wouldn't have made it. She said, you know, we barely saved you last night, kind of thing. So with that information, the next time I got sentenced, and she said, I was arrested for another action, but the action took place before my sentencing on the first case. And she was, Judge Fitzpatrick said, well, you should have known. I said, well, you obviously didn't read your, the information we gave you, because I was sentenced and did my court time after I was arrested for the second charge. So I had no way of knowing how tough it would be in jail and that I would get sick. And at that point, we introduced the fact that I was sick after I got out. And she still sentenced me to jail anyway. And this time, the exact same thing happened. I went into jail. We also appealed the case, the charges, and we ended up in the second case. So I was sentenced to jail. And I went in and got, again, they didn't give me meds. And I had a massive heart attack while I was in jail, and ended up at Eagle Ridge Hospital. And the doctor there said most of the people from that pretrial center are there because they didn't get their meds. So it's a systemic policy that they have. You have to say as well, pretrial is where people go who have not yet been convicted normally. We had been convicted and we were waiting for placement in the right facility. But a lot of the people there haven't even been convicted. So that actually becomes an act of classism, right? That this class of people aren't entitled to them to eagerly follow the need as doctors to give them their meds. And then it becomes racism out of the classism, because we still have 70% of the people, irregardless of what's been said, recommended by the courts or anything else, that are indigenous. Mm-hmm. So there's still, you know, the stuff is still continuing around that. Anyway, we appealed the second sentence, the second conviction. I was doing a pipe ceremony, and I had been doing other stuff. They had a blockade. The other people had a blockade. I was showing some information about the fact that they were shipping contaminated soil out of the tank farm.
Oh my God!
And so we had a blockade there, and I was over beyond the blockade, showing to the media what was going on. Then I waited for all the media to be gone and everything to settle down, and I went over to end the blockade with a pipe ceremony, and the police were involved in the pipe ceremony with us, and nothing happened. I said to them, "Well, okay, we're going to finish the pipe ceremony. It's only going to take about 20 more minutes, and then we're going to go." And we finished the pipe ceremony and we left, and that was the 2nd of December. On the 20th of December, my lawyer calls me and said, "What'd you do?" I said, "What are you talking about?" He says, "Well, they just issued a warrant for your arrest." I said, "What?" And I had to think about it. I said, "Hang on, I haven't done anything since the 2nd of December." And he looked and said, "Yeah, that's what the warrant's for." And so anyway, we appealed the case, and they found that the prosecution was wrong, that the judge was wrong, and that I was, in fact, holding a ceremony for the mens rea, what I talked about before, the intent to show contempt for the government was not there. My intent was to hold a pipe ceremony at the instruction of my elders. So I was to hold a pipe ceremony to end the blockade and to end it peacefully, and that's what I was doing. So they actually found in my favor, and they also found that in the process that nothing was considered around Gladue, nothing was considered around recommendations from the prosecution service that Indigenous people not go to jail. And then they said that in fact the judge had far overstepped her rights, because what a judge has to do is take what's put in front of her and consider it. And what they found her doing was digging deeper to justify the prosecution. So she's not sitting in a neutral place. She's sitting in a biased place where she's... So anyway, they ordered that that case be canceled and that they could try me again, which so that's without prejudice, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when we came to court, they turned around the Attorney General's deputy Attorney General was in there, and I don't know what he said, but all I know for sure is that the prosecutor said, "We've taken a look at it, and that we have no hope that this case would come out any differently, that we would have the same result," because they had given me permission to do different things that they were now punishing me for doing, right? It's like holding pipe ceremonies and holding them on the road and stuff. So that was that. But anyway, where we're at right now, and I guess one of the things I've learned as an activist is it isn't necessarily what's right in front of your face that you're dealing with. It can be other things, and that's what happened here. So we are now we went last year, we're going again. In the last case, we're going in this one. We're going to the... what do you call them? We're going to the College of Physicians and Surgeons, to their ethics board, and we're challenging what happened, and we're challenging the doctor. We're going to the Nurses Association and challenging the nurses. They're all a part of this systemic thing, right? And hopefully, and all. also the Ombudsman has been asking that there be outside auditing of the correction system because she sees the problem. So we're going to all of those places, and that's our fight right now around that. So you're always fighting in more than one different level, right? So
starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
The Art of the Mixtape is not lost. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
And it seems like this injustice system, it goes all around. It's not just the legal system, as you've mentioned, you're fighting it in multiple battlefronts. Mm-hmm. And I think when we were facing a recent election, so we saw the same government being reelected. Mm-hmm. And we're not taking a stand here or anything that's better or the worst, but we do know that there is a continuity of these colonial parties that, like you see for any of the candidates, they all have the same standard like politics based on this colonial rule. Like they, none of those have a different type of rule or anything like that.
Yeah, the I'm going to speak to that in a really, really specific sense from the downtown east side, and we see what's going on there. Mm-hmm. And we see that a majority of the people on the street are also Indigenous people, and there's no housing being provided. They're coming in the morning and taking everything they used for shelter the night before and taking it away and throwing it in the garbage. They have police watching and making sure they get away with doing it. So that's one part of it, but I'm going to go that. So that's the city. We have a billionaire in charge of the city right now. Mr. Sims owns several businesses and restaurants and a nursing business and all this. If he was to sell all of his entities, they'd be worth over $1 billion. So this is the guy. We call him Peloton Ken because he took one of the lecture rooms and set it up with his Peloton equipment so that he could have an exercise room. Not lecture room, one of the conference rooms. You know? So it's like...
Screen.
So you have these major narcissists that are running our world. As we talk about, I'm going to talk about two things. One is we had a very strong female Indigenous... MLA, who ended up having to resign, ended up stepping back because she was getting bullied from behind. So if you have a strong personality, a strong person, and you look at our government systems, it's been strong Indigenous people all over the place that have made differences, you know? Mm-hmm. There was an Indigenous man standing up with a feather who said, no, we're not going to do the Meech Lake Accord. You know, and he held the federal government hostage until he agreed. You know, and we have so we had one MLA who I absolutely honor and was and had to step back because she couldn't put up with the racism and the hatred that was coming to her because she dared to stand up and assert herself as an Indigenous person with rights in that caucus. So they made a big mistake and we ended up electing what's her name? Phillips. And she's powerful, you know? Stuart Phillips' wife. she's a very powerful person, and she's he always concedes that, because we run by matriarchies, he always concedes that she was the power behind him. She was the one who pushed him forward and made him become the president of the BC Union of Indian Chiefs and stuff, mm-hmm. right? But now she's in there. But what it's like, if you dare, in a patriarchal, misogynist society, if you dare to stand up as a woman of a different culture, you're in trouble. And that's what happened there, right? And now they've run into into someone who will not be intimidated and won't be pushed around, and neither would our other sister. So I'm just going to go another one that you look at. We talk about... there are two different sets of government in the indigenous nation. There's the traditional, that's the chiefs, traditional chiefs and traditional clan mothers and all that. And then there's the ones that the government forced the indigenous nations to take as the chiefs and council. And I'm not going to say all chiefs and council are bad, but I'm going to say the process they arrived at with that was wrong. Mm-hmm. They took and basically stopped Squamish as an example. They wouldn't give them anything to pave the roads or pay for the water or any of the stuff that they normally have to agree to and do, provide as a part of the Indian Act on reservations. They just stopped doing that, and they said, until you guys become an elected chief and council, we will not deal with you.
Right.
So now we have two sets of government, one that the indigenous nations recognize, the traditional mm-hmm. chiefs and council, or chiefs and elders, and then the elected chiefs and council, and it just brings colonialism. The elected chiefs and council, its aim was to bring colonialism into the nations. So the other thing, you know, they talked about, and this isn't about activism, but it probably is in the end. They talked about bringing in an UNDRIP, the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People. And so the provincial government, they got right ahead of it, and they said, oh, we're going to bring that in. And they did ADRIP, and I don't know what that means, what the A stands. But anyway, what they did, though, is they framed it around, again, chiefs and council. They didn't frame it around... So it's only, first of all, chiefs and council are only responsible for the territory that the reserve is on. Very, very clear physical boundary. All the rest of the territory, they're not responsible for. So the traditional chiefs are. And that's why you see all these fights. These fights that are going on around the right, around the blocking of pipelines and everything else, are going on by the traditional people. They're saying, you can't run this across our land. This is our hunting territory. Well, there's no hunting territory quite often in the reserve. Those are quite small, you know, almost like a town. So it's like the country doesn't count, but the town does. So they're saying, well, we have traditional land here. We have sacred land here. You can't run this stuff. You can't do it without our permission. And they work their way around it by saying, well, we're not dealing with you guys. We're dealing with the chiefs and council. And there's another point that's made. I talked earlier about sovereign territory.
Mm-hmm.
A sovereign nation governs itself and is not allied with another nation unless it chooses to be. So what they turn around, they do now is they turn around and they say, well, there's only the two nations down here that don't want the pipeline. The rest of these nations all do. But in actual fact, a sovereign nation would be like standing up and saying, well, all of Europe doesn't want a pipeline, although France does. You know, France is a sovereign nation. If you were to say to France, well, Germany's going to tell you what to do. Well, we saw what happened when Germany tried to tell them what to do. But, yeah, we say Germany's going to tell you what to do. And that all these other nations have lined up against you, you're still going to say, well, no, but I'm a sovereign. I'm independent. We are French-speaking, or as we would say, you know, we're from... Coast Salish Nations, or we're Anishinaabe, or whatever, right? And we have the right to determine what happens on our land. And that isn't done, and the irony of it, I'm going to say as well, is that, getting away from the UNDRIP thing, the irony of it is I go into court, and they arrest me because I'm standing on our own territory at the direction of our elders.